Now, I know what you're asking. How did we get here? What turn of events caused three brats from California to end up performing at Woodstock 94, aka Mudstock, and even caused Mike Dirnt to lose a bunch of teeth? We will discuss this later on this episode, but for now, let's focus on the album Dookie by Green Day for this episode of Retro Reviews. If I asked you to list a few bands that released iconic albums in their time, you could easily rattle off half a dozen. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Metallica, and Nirvana are a few that come to mind, with each of them releasing albums in their genres that would respectively shape their fields. Green Day is no different. Not only did they pull this feat off, but they did it twice in different stages of their career and times in music, in different decades, in different centuries. In different millenniums, if you want to get pedantic about it. We are getting old. What do I mean by this? Well, Green Day have released albums that would change the course of punk rock and become the icons for not only just one wave of punk rock, but two, with the albums American Idiot and Dookie. But we're only here to talk about their first meteoric rise to fame and the album that would kick off a new wave of punk music, a third wave of punk, a one for the 90s. A style that is often called pop punk, and 1994 was a great year for punk rock music. Green Day weren't always called Green Day. In fact, they weren't always a three-piece outfit. Back in the late 80s, for a brief stint, they were a four-piece outfit called Blood Rage, with Raj Punjabi on drums, Sean Hughes on bass, and Mike Dirnt and Billy Joel on guitars and vocals. And then they became Sweet Children, with John Kiffmeyer on drums. Could you imagine either of these band names now for the group? I wonder if Axl would have tried to sue the band for using their image like some other punk rock band they sued. The band's previous drummer Raj has stated in an interview with the Being Famous podcast, he left the band and wasn't kicked out, but didn't state why. The reason would be in his book, which as of writing this has yet to be released.
So why'd you leave?
I can't tell you.
Come on, Raj, give me something, dude. Doesn't really answer the question as to why you left, but that's okay, we will wait for the book. Whenever that comes out. When is the book coming out?
I don't know exactly when it's coming out yet. It's just in the early stages right now.
Okay.
But I will keep you in the loop with that.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
When it comes to the band's name, there are a few stories, but it all boils down to one very obvious answer. Smoke weed every day.
Serious?
I mean, if it wasn't obvious enough, then yes, Green Day is a slang term from the Bay Area for getting stoned all day. Although I'm pretty sure this term is ubiquitous for use.
You were other names and then you became Green Day, which I always thought, maybe it's an urban myth, that it was about pot.
It was absolutely about pot.
All right.
Yeah.
Either way, the fact remains the same. The band changed their name to a song of the same name they recorded from one of the earlier EPs when they couldn't use the name Sweet Children, as they might get confused with another band in the area with a very similar name called Sweet Babies. Now that's a horrible band name. Green Day is what they would become, and the trio of Billy Joe Armstrong on guitars and vocals, Mike Dirnt on bass and backing vocals, with Trey Cool on drums, would make up the band that has been unchanged for 35 years. As far as early music goes for the band, the group would do the punk rock approach by releasing about 4 or 5 EPs while in school between 1989 to 1990, all of which would appear on their compilation record called 1039/Smoothed Out Slappy Hours. And Kerplunk would drop in 1991, but with little fanfare, with one exception, and that was a then little known single, Welcome to Paradise. Now, it's not unheard of for a band to re-record an earlier song for a future release, but it's not often seen. The B-52s did this with their song Rock Lobster, and Frank Sinatra did this a bunch of times, but it shouldn't be confused with reissuing an album, which is usually done by artists to regain financial control over their music. Instead, their original version was a much more raw-sounding affair, as to be expected from its production quality in this record. So, the inclusion to re-record this song for the album is a bonus in my books, and a clever move by the record execs who saw its potential. Now, I'm not a Green Day super fan, but I know as far as their catalogue goes, Kaplunk is very overlooked, and given their future releases, I'm not surprised, to be honest. This album shows the band starting to adjust their sound for what they would become, but is limited in its production quality. Green Day wanted to appease their original fanbase, but at the same time, they were outgrowing their demographic and knew they had to take a chance. So they would sign on to Reprise Records for Dookie, which was a subsidiary for Warner Music Group, and to say this off the hardcore fanbase would be an understatement. In fact, it felt to a lot on the scene that they had turned their backs on them and sold out completely. Akin to, I don't know. Yeah, I guess that comes to mind, but we will talk about the cover in detail later in this episode. For now, let's focus on the singles. The album had four singles released from the record over the course of 12 months, and considering the success of the album, I thought that they may have pushed for another one or two. But I guess the record company didn't really expect punk music to take off as much as it did. I mean, this was the era of grunge. Oh, never mind. Despite the passing of an icon, everyone knew the early 90s alt-rock scene was in despair due to reasons, and maybe this helped give the band's first single a chance to succeed. Longview has got to be the best song on the album. I think this might have been the first song I heard by the band, or at least the one that left an impression on me, and given its highly iconic bassline intro, how can you blame me? After hearing this song for the first time, I ran home to the Tabmaster website to learn how to play it on my bass guitar. Actually, does anyone still use that site? Regardless, I've always felt that the lyrics really spoke to me at this point in time. No, not that line. But oddly enough, can be updated for a more recent and current platform, wink. No, it's this line. Just in case you couldn't tell, this song is about, you know, walking the dog, jerking the gherkin, slapping the salami, clearing the snorkel, choking the chicken, playing the single string air guitar, Trump firing his apprentice, dropping off some knuckle children, helping the Kleenex College Lady Fund.
Lady, he's putting my kids through college.
You know, love thyself. When you are in the adolescent age bracket, this line, no, really, the whole song, just speaks the truth. And I find it funny that a song with this line and subject matter for this instance would go on to even win a Grammy. This happened in 1995 for the Best Alternative Music Performance, when only a few years earlier, Trent Reznor won a Grammy for his song, Wish, which contained the lyric, Fist F**k. It's like the Grammys were trying to go for an edgy approach in the 90s to overcorrect their embarrassment upon awarding Jethro Tull an award over Metallica for Best Metal Performance. Trent Reznor has also stated he wants his epitaph to read, Reznor died, said fist f**k, and won a Grammy. Still, it wouldn't be the last time the Grammys were won by some song about sexual gratification. Wars in this house, wars in this house. Oh wait, that didn't win? Guess I'll be keeping my faith in humanity for now. Do you have the time to listen to me whine? Okay, I might have gotten a little ahead of myself when I said Longview was the best song on this album. In 2021, Rolling Stone magazine voted this song number 150 in the top 500 greatest songs ever written, which is a monumental task. And clearly they are onto something here, because as it stands, Basket Case has been streamed nearly 1 billion times on Spotify. Which means Green Day made enough money from this one song being played on their platform to buy their own CD in a record store. The video clip for the song also helped the band, and while it's nothing crazy, it's just the band performing in an asylum looking zonked out of their brains. so probably their natural state. The director chosen for this video clip had previously worked on A Nightmare Before Christmas in the camera and electrical department. As well as that, he had directed music videos for Primus and his songs My Name is Mud and DMV. The band seemed to like his style, as he would also direct future videos for their songs Hitchin' a Ride and Good Riddance. Now, I feel that I should point out at this point that according to the best source of information, Wikipedia, the chord progression in this song follows Pachelbel's canon. Oh, wait a second, Basket Case is in the key of E-flat. Let me correct this. Yeah, I'm not hearing it either. What if I were to speed up the tempo? Yeah, maybe, I guess. Now, I'm sure by chance the chord progression does, but I don't think this was a nod or an ode to the classical music scene fans who listen to punk. All three of them, that is. Something tells me they're not drawing their inspiration to Bach. Or maybe they are, and we just aren't aware of it yet. Anyhow, this tune would be Green Day's signature song before some other single dropped 10 years later, and it certainly earned the band's fair share of fans. It would spend 5 weeks at the top of the modern rock charts, and I mean, look at the rest of this list. It's some stiff competition here with Weezer, Offspring, Nine Inch Nails, Stone Temple Pilots, and Soundgarden 2. I mean, Green Day was still a new band and relatively, well, green.
Smart-ass motherfucker!
But they stood firm at the crease. By the way, Yanks, that's a cricket term. Ironically, the song's lyrics also insinuate the solicitation of a male prostitute, as if the protagonist is batting for the other team.
I'm walking here!
That's another cricketing slang for you. Google it. You know, in hindsight, it seemed like a no-brainer to make this song the next single from the album. Looking at it from a marketing angle, it was a perfect move to release this tune after the success Green Day saw from Woodstock 94, which of course saw that massive mud fight between the crowd and the band. At least they saw the fun in it, just like Trent Reznor did. I mean, it could have been worse.
Woodstock 99.
Quick, I need some water!
Not in this lifetime.
Welcome to Paradise was a well-received, tried-and-tested stable song by the band before Dookie was even recorded, and the song's newfound success was helped by the video clip that would be on high rotation by the MTV channel when they still understood what the letter M stood for in their namesake. Interestingly enough, the video clip involves the band just playing a live gig to a small fanbase. A simple yet effective clip of pogo stick enthusiasts lumped into a small club to see the band perform, but this video clip was actually taken from a live performance they played on the day Dookie dropped. So there's a truth nugget for you. Use this piece of trivia to impress some Sheila down at your local. Another oddball factoid is that the guitar riff was originally written by Trey Cool and the drums were performed by Billy Joe, when they used to swap instruments often. I guess this kind of makes more sense when you're looking at the Father of All Motherfuckers album. No, none of that here today. There is something so carefree and nonchalant about this riff playing over a fairly complex bass line. Damn you, Mike, you beautiful beast of that four-stringed instrument. I feel it's necessary to point out a quote I once heard describing punk music as good music played by bad musicians. I don't recall who said it, but I have a feeling it might have been Fat Mike from NoFX fame. Contrary to this statement, however, is a trend that would be prevalent in the prominent new 90s punk wave bands. I mean, all of the songs already mentioned beforehand have amazing riffs, but the bass lines in each of these tunes just rose to the occasion, and this is a common theme in most of the bands of this era, such as Rancid, Lagwagon, NoFX, and Friends of Rom. These groups understood that it's one thing to have a great riff, but it's another level to add an interesting bass line. And When I Come Around is just another one of these songs. Now, I said this was a single from the album, but technically, that's not true. You see, the song was receiving airplay at the time due to the success of the record, so the label withheld dropping it to pump the album sales up. Not that it was really needed. I mean, the album went platinum in the US in August, and by the end of the year, it would go on to be triple platinum. The record would eventually end up going 10 times platinum, just an FYI. You know, when I set about doing any of these episodes and do this section, I like to think that these are killer songs from the record that might have been overlooked or perhaps not really well known, because maybe the lead singles were just that big and the rest of what is on offer just seems to fade away into non-existence. But when you look over this album and compare its 14 tracks to their best of album called International Super Hits, you can see that 5 of these songs made their way over there, including Jar, which was an outtake from the Dookie sessions. So in reality, Super Hits contains the deep cut, and I believe the songs I'm about to mention are fairly well known already. Regardless of being repetitive, I will read my list, albeit in a much shorter manner than other episodes in this series. To no one's surprise, 2 of the 3 songs are going to be Burnout and She. Both amazing songs, as Burnout opens the album up to what we can expect from the band, and She has a great solo driving bass line that plods along until the guitars kick in and just transform that tune. The last one I want to mention is The End. Not that song, this song. This is a short, no bullshit tune that I wish closed off the album, but alas, we still have FOD and the bonus hidden track to contend with. Oh, and by the way, if you were wondering what FOD stands for, well, FOD is the 14th track from the Green Day's Dookie album, and quite simply, it stands for off and die. This isn't a bad song, but takes some time to get to the point.
Yes, get over there!
As for the hidden track All By Myself, well, that song can just FOD. It's a stupid way to close out the album, and easily the dumbest song on an otherwise stellar album. When you look over the album artwork for Dookie, you can't help but notice it's such an iconic cover. I mean, this is an artwork that has stood the test of time, but also contains a fair bit of mystery within it. The album artwork was illustrated by East Bay punk rock icon Richie Butcher and has several Easter eggs within. The most obvious one is a plane dropping bombs on what is Telegraph Avenue, and in my mind, this is a bit of a stab at the band's history, as they were centered around this street and started to make a name for themselves in the underground punk scene, particularly at 924 Gilman Street, where they would perform. However, after the news spread that they were signed to Warner Brothers via Reprise, fans would turn their backs to the punk rockers and not attend their gigs, with the band even being blacklisted to perform at that venue. As stated by Billy Joe, "I couldn't go back to the punk scene, whether we were the biggest success in the world or the biggest failure. The only thing I could do was get on my bike and go forward." Knowing this, I think you can see why the artwork of the scene being bombed is so symbolic in a sense of destroying their past, but blowing up on the scene at the same time. On top of this, there are a few other Easter eggs, such as the lady from the original Black Sabbath album, Angus Young playing guitar on the top of the building here, and underneath is Patti Smith recreating the album artwork for Easter, and of course, a fat Elvis. But let's not forget the namesake of the album, the Dookie. Dookie. Dookie.
Shut the fuck up!
If you have any poo, fling it now.
I mean, this just speaks to the band's juvenile phase with the artwork that was chosen for selection. Actually, that has been a bit on the retainer, so it's not like the band have grown up, just grown old. When you think about it, you would be rather hard-pressed to have avoided this album back in the 90s, and the timing of this record is an important factor for its success. As with most successful records of their era, timing is a very valuable thing. The grunge movement had burnt out and was on its last legs, with the public over their angsty tunes and lyrics. This, combined with the passing of Kurt Cobain only 2 months after the album's release, was almost symbolic of the changing of the guard. The public wanted to break out and have some fun, and no longer wanted to take life so seriously. I think this is perfectly portrayed in the Green Day's live performance at Woodstock. Just look at this shitstorm. Instead of fighting the crowd, they embraced it and encouraged people to throw mud at them, even throw throwing it back. It looks like fun, and if I was there, I would be doing the same bloody thing.
Mud spelled backwards is dumb.
Yes, it's dumb, but it's just dumb fun. When this album dropped, it opened the floodgates for many other bands in their field to follow suit, as would be evident with other contemporary groups such as The Offspring with Smash, or Lagwagon with their record Trash, or Rancid with And Out Come the Wolves, or NoFX and their album Punk in Drublic, the latter of which was a bit of frustration from Fat Mike and Co, who, as they stated, toured with each of these groups and saw each of them starting to make it big, but they were still lurking in the shadows. Also, there is an interesting story about Fat Mike kidnapping Billy Joe, but I'll save that for a future episode of Retro Review, so keep an eye out for Punk in Drublic's review later this year. The band would become massively iconic after this album, and with their success, they were even being name-dropped by Weezer on their Pinkerton album. Hey, you know you've made it when you get mentioned in a Weezer song. Ratings. Dookie has a lot of critical acclaim, and the scores really reflect this, with AllMusic giving a perfect score of 5 out of 5, Alternative Press giving a perfect score of 5 out of 5, Billboard giving a score of 4.5 out of 5, Chicago Sun-Times giving a score of 3.5 out of 4, Chicago Tribune giving a score of 3.5 out of 4, and the Rolling Stones giving a perfect score of 5 out of 5, Pitchfork giving 8.7 out of 10, Spin Alternative Record Guide giving an 8 out of 10, and the Village Voice giving an A-. The lowest score was from NME, with an overall score of 7 out of 10. Over at Rate Your Music's website, the album sits with a score of 3.61 out of 5 from over 20,000 reviews, which is reasonably high for an album of this status. As for me, I would give this album a score of 13 million chilies on the spicy scale, with my favourite tracks being Burnout, Longview, She, and Welcome to Paradise. It's been a blast listening to this album and reliving my youth. Green Day's Warning was the first and only tape I ever owned, and our cassette player chewed through it after the first few seconds of playing it, so I missed an opportunity to get into their music much earlier than I did. But luckily a friend lent me their copy of International Super Hits a few years later, and this allowed me to dive into their tunes. Admittedly, I was getting into punk via the Ramones, Sex Pistols and The Offspring before I had got my hands on this album, but Green Day's Dookie sounded so good and different from what I had heard thus far. If there are any drawbacks I can say about this album, it's got to be with the lyrics, which are admittedly rather juvenile and stuck in a young teenager's mindset, but this only applies for a small handful of tracks as opposed to something by Blink-182. Yeah, picture that. Green Day being more mature than Blink-182. Anyhow, I think the production for this era is great, teetering almost over the edge, but it's not to the point that Nirvana's Nevermind was done. The music itself is timeless and fulfills a primal desire that only power chords can fill, but in the same breath has complexities that are uncommon at least for this era of punk rock within certain songs. Ultimately, I would say that this serves as an accessible time capsule of mid-90s culture at the end of the day, and you can't help but have some fun when listening to this record. If you have made it this far, I thank you for checking out this episode. Do the social things, share it with other people, and hell, even lambast it on Green Day's socials. I want them to see what I have to say. So make sure for the 30th anniversary of Dookie to go forth and listen to this album again. If you've enjoyed this content, make sure to smash that like button, subscribe to us, and stay notified for future music-related content, because it keeps our manager happy at the end of the day. We are also on Discord, Instagram, Facebook, and all those other social platforms if you want to check us out. As always, people, you have a great day and stay spicy.